produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, The Growing Truth About Cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, artists, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, stash.normal.org. And continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. Visit www.redaphid.com. It's Wednesday, April 16th, and it's 4:20 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Melville. You can make a difference in the fight to end adult marijuana prohibition. Join up with the dedicated, hardworking activists of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws at norml.org. If you have a product that you would like to market to the cannabis community, you can advertise on the Daily Audio Stash. Your ad will be focused on exactly the customer base you're seeking out, the thousands of responsible cannabis consumers who download and listen to this show. Our listeners are educated consumers who want to support the businesses that support the growing truth about cannabis, and we deliver the advertising freedom you won't find on radio, TV, or print ads. To advertise on the Daily Audio Stash, send me an email at stash@normal.org. Wednesday is Cannabis Science Day on the Stash, and coming up after the news, we're separating the stems of propaganda from the buds of truth with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Today, Dr. Mitch and I discuss the lead contamination found in some German marijuana and the insane idea of treating marijuana addiction with lithium. Cannabis Carrie brings us our musical break this Hemp Day Hump Day with an Asian rapper named Khmer Kid. Based in Los Angeles, Khmer Kid's anthem, Smoke Weed, will bring you back down from your tax day anxiety. Then we wrap things up with Dale Gehringer, the executive director of California Normal. Dale's got some great news about the fight to protect California's Prop 215 patients from employment discrimination. So welcome to the show. Grab your best glass and sit back with your favorite strain. This is your Normal Daily Audio Stash. Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our Normal Daily Audio Stash, Hemp Headlines. Woman shot by off-duty officer had marijuana and alcohol in her system. From Fox 6, San Diego, California. A woman shot by an off-duty San Diego police officer in Oceanside last month had a blood alcohol level of nearly twice the legal limit and also had marijuana in her system, according to search warrants made public Monday. Oceanside police investigators have determined that a near collision on Old Grove Road evidently led to the March 15th confrontation, during which off-duty San Diego police officer Franklin White opened fire on 27-year-old Rachel Silva's car, wounding her and her 8-year-old son. White and his wife were southbound in their black Mercury sedan when, according to a witness, Silva steered her Honda out of a gas station directly into their path, forcing the officer to swerve sharply to avoid a crash. White, 28, then continued down the road for a short distance and pulled into a parking lot outside a Lowe's store, according to Oceanside police investigators. As he did so, Silva, whose son was seated next to her, reportedly tailgated him, revved her engine, and yelled, prompting the 911 call from White's wife, a Carlsbad police dispatcher, Oceanside police have said. The off-duty officer stopped his car, and Silva pulled alongside. White responded by displaying a pistol and backing his car away, as Silva, in turn, made an emergency call, reporting a man with a gun, according to police. She then reversed her car as well, sideswiping lights in the process. At that point, the officer opened fire through his closed driver's side window, shattering it, police said. The first bullet went through the darkly tinted front passenger window of Silva's vehicle, striking her son in the left leg, and four others pierced her windshield. Two of those slugs struck her in the upper right arm. Silva and her child both spent about 5 days in the hospital. The night of the shooting, Silva was driving on a suspended license and facing a drunk driving charge in connection with a prior arrest. Police ordered her blood taken at the hospital. All right, so let me get this straight. A drunk woman is driving on a suspended license with her 8-year-old. She whips out of a gas station and nearly hits a car of an off-duty cop. She has a bit of road rage and follows the cop. Suddenly, the cop, who she doesn't know is a cop, flashes a handgun. Drunk woman panics and tries to escape, sideswipes cop's car, so he begins opening fire? Now, how exactly does the marijuana have anything to do with this? You had me at twice the legal limit for alcohol and suspended license. Finding marijuana, quote, in her system just means she smoked some pot sometime within the last few weeks. It doesn't turn her into a road-raging demolition derby driver. That's the alcohol talking. As for this cop, if he feels his life is threatened, he absolutely has the right to open fire, but he's in his closed, parked car, and she couldn't have possibly built up any serious speed pulling away from the man threatening her with a gun. And at that short distance, could the cop not have seen the 8-year-old? Do you think maybe he should have flashed his badge instead of his gun? Medical Marijuana Initiative officially qualifies for Michigan's 2008 ballot. When the Michigan Board of Canvassers officially certified the signatures of MPP's campaign committee, the Michigan Coalition for Compassionate Care, submitted last month, the Michigan legislature had 40 days to act by either passing the initiative into law itself or sending the question to the voters to decide. And those 40 days were officially up on Friday, April 11. With the legislature taking no action, the Medical Marijuana Initiative will automatically go onto the November ballot. The fact that the voters will have the opportunity to make Michigan the 13th medical marijuana state is great news for Michigan's patients. Support for a compassionate law is wide and deep across the state. The most recent polling shows 67% of voters favor medical marijuana access, and five Michigan cities, Ann Arbor, Detroit, Ferndale, Flint, and Traverse City, have already passed local medical marijuana initiatives. And last year, MCCC activists collected nearly 500,000 signatures from Michiganders, verified by the Board of Canvassers at a whopping 80.2% validity rate to get this initiative on the ballot. Further evidence of this broad, statewide support. While the government lies about pot, a couple stories from the Washington Post. Two teams of researchers with access to thousands of documents gathered for lawsuits over the painkiller Vioxx allege that Merck waged a campaign of deception to promote its drug, moving slowly to warn of possible hazards while at the same time dressing up in-house studies as the work of independent academic researchers. Vioxx, whose generic name is Rofecoxib, went on the market in 1999. It became a blockbuster, with $2.3 billion in sales in 2003. But Merck voluntarily withdrew it in September 2004 after several studies showed that it increased the risk of heart attacks and strokes. Since then, Merck has been named in 26,500 lawsuits by people who say the drug harmed them. Last fall, the company created a $4.85 billion fund to settle the claims while not admitting that Vioxx caused heart attacks, strokes, or death. And federal regulators suspect that Baxter International's recalled blood thinner, heparin, was intentionally contaminated to increase profit, the head of the Food and Drug Administration said yesterday. Baxter recalled most of its heparin products in February after reports of allergic reactions and death. An FDA investigation later uncovered a heparin-like substance in some batches of the drug's active ingredient, which is made in China. FDA Commissioner Andrew von Eschenbach added that the FDA is not investigating the motive, but would leave that to Chinese officials. Well, maybe if our federal government stopped spending so much time and resources fighting the medical marijuana that never killed anyone, they could step up regulation and testing of the pharmaceuticals that are killing people. Once again, we see pharmaceutical company profits allowing them to get away with murder.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 12 states today, and THCF has medical clinics in 6 of those states. Our physicians help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms as in multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help them obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, Colorado, Nevada, Hawaii, and California. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at www.hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Returning to the Daily Audio Stash is our good friend Dr. Mitch Earlywine, who's Associate Professor of Psychology at the State University of New York at Albany, who joins us every Wednesday here on the Daily Audio Stash. Dr. Earlywine, welcome back.
Oh, I love being on the show.
We had ourselves, and it's a happy 420 week to you as well.
Oh, and thanks so much, and same to you.
we had this story that was quite alarming from last week's stash, and I thought I'd hold off on talking more about this until I got a chance to run it by you. But it was about this story coming out of Germany where they were finding lead flakes in some people's marijuana stashes. Presumably the dealers were adding lead to make the marijuana weigh more so they could make more money off of it. And is this the first time you've heard of something like this? And what can people, how can people prevent this from happening?
I was really suspicious when I first heard about this story, but there was a letter to the editor in the New England Journal of Medicine suggesting that a number of patients in Germany now, not here in the States, had come in with lead poisoning and, in fact, had been regular cannabis users. And when you look closely at the data that they present, these are folks with 10 to 20 times the amount of lead in their blood that they're normally supposed to have. So seriously, they had genuine lead poisoning. This was not just some crazy government cover-up like the old 1970s paraquat stories we used to hear, and I'm happy to get into that as well. When you take a close look at the pictures they provide, there actually are lead flakes in the bottom of the bag. It looked like it may have been something as simple as somebody just throwing a little bit of lead in the bottom of a bag, but then there was another picture that suggested perhaps someone had sprayed really small flecks of lead all throughout the bag. And obviously, on a single gram, this isn't going to have that much of an impact, but if you're selling, large amounts, this does, in fact, add up over a time. This is probably one of the most frightening ones of these I've heard in the last 30 years, and I originally thought maybe this was some kind of anti-drug alarmist craziness, but when you see these blood draws and these blood levels reported, I really do trust these data. Obviously, what people need to do is take a close look in their baggies and make sure there isn't, some fishing line weight hanging out in the bottom. But also, is there any strange discoloration, any curious metallic look to the cannabis, which of course would be, extremely suspicious and just horrible. But also, if they have any strange feelings in reaction to the cannabis, then again, also you want to go ahead to emergency medicine. But all in all, I haven't seen a case of this yet reported in the United States. I certainly hope dealers here wouldn't, stoop to anything so low. But man, oh man, do we need a taxed and regulated market when we start hearing stories like this. Clearly, if there was any kind of supervision or way for folks to have cannabis approved and for, open sale to adults across the nation, we could certainly sidestep what is by far the most poisonous metallic issue of all, lead. It's just a mind blower.
What are some of the things people would notice symptom-wise if they had gotten some of this lead-tainted marijuana?
The spooky thing about this is they may not notice anything right away, and then suddenly, literally, people who are just smoking, a couple of times a week, it might take 30 days for them to suddenly notice all kinds of strange fatigue, neuropathic pain, strange feelings in the limbs, in the arms and legs, and things like that. and just a real incredible difficulty in breathing or strange things along those lines, depending on how severe the poisoning is. I hesitate to even pretend like, you know, this is something people can just sort of diagnose on their own. It's just such a crazy predicament, and something that, you know, obviously staying away from the cannabis that originated the problem is, of course, a big issue, but there are really strong, really important medications that can undo lead poisoning, and that's a hard thing to even have to think about, but something that has to be dealt with, you know, pretty early on. Oftentimes when folks go in, it's something as simple as headache or insomnia, and they'll get questions about, you know, do you have a lot of body piercings, or do you work around lead paint or something along those lines. So if you are using cannabis and experience some of these symptoms, take your cannabis with you so that they can try to identify if that's necessarily the source.
Now, would anyone notice a difference in smell or taste if they were stuck with some of this marijuana?
What's curious is there's actually little lead flakes in the bottom of the bags that they show in the study. So if you're shaking your, you've got strong buds there that are pretty firm, and you grind them up and you notice metallic pieces falling out, that's, of course, the most outrageous telltale sign. And it's funny how something as simple as a magnifying glass could make all the difference, so that it's not something that is the same color as, say, the glands or the green parts of the plant. It really is that lead gray color, and something that would be pretty obvious once you got it under the light with a decent magnifying glass.
But other than visually, you don't suspect there's a way to taste or smell it.
It seems like getting it to even burn would be cumbersome and hard to detect in a reliable way. So I can't imagine that would be a reliable way to experience it. The other problem, of course, is that there is such a thing as lead intoxication, and so people do experience this crazy dizziness and sort of something akin to loss of consciousness, but that usually means the dose is incredibly high, and if that accompanies a headache, that's a pretty strong sign that blood lead levels are getting way too high.
Now, this is not the only adulterant that we would have encountered in cannabis studies throughout the years. You mentioned the paraquat from the 70s, and it seems like this adulterant here has to do with trying to increase profits by making the marijuana weigh more. What other sort of adulterants would people have to worry about in a black market cannabis system?
It's scary to think about, but in fact, people who don't actually have real cannabis have heard certain legends about, oh, add this or add that to some other green matter and sort of hope for the best, and that people will be intoxicated from these other substances. Those tend to be urban legends. Those aren't actually showing up in confiscated cannabis, at least in most of the studies that have been done from the labs down in Mississippi, for example. The paraquat issue was one of an herbicide that was sprayed around in fields primarily in Mexico in the 1970s that was designed to essentially just kill all the plants in these large Mexican fields. And there were even some areas in Georgia and Kentucky that had also been sprayed. This is a horrible habit because this is an herbicide that is extremely toxic even at low doses. And anytime you spray anything into the air, of course it's going to spread around and have the potential to harm people, livestock, and other crops. And Keith Stripp was, in fact, incredibly outspoken about this and did a lot, I think, to get that ended in the 1970s. Most of our listeners probably don't remember this, and I was actually in grade school at the time, but remember hearing a big outcry, and this got a lot of marijuana smokers activated nationwide to say, you know, this is another example of how, you know, the drug war is basically a war on a certain subculture of the population, and this is completely unfair and got people really motivated. As it turns out, paraquat pyrolyzes, meaning once it's lit on fire, it actually is destroyed, and it wasn't toxic, and it wasn't going to create the negative consequences that we all feared, but it still seems like such a horrible thing to have to absorb in your respiratory tract, and so it was nice that everybody rallied around and got that put to an end at the time, but I feel like this is in the back pocket of DEA agents and other folks who are, you know, against larger cannabis crops. And something we just want to keep in mind again, there were, at least in the 70s, these paraquat testing kits that were for sale almost immediately as soon as it hit the news. And, in fact, those were completely ineffective and just a scam, which is another sad thing about how here, because we're in a subculture that essentially relies on an underground market, we are victim of other things that are also going to basically play on that market. So I feel like the paraquat issue is not a big issue, but sort of a symbol of how this kind of abuse can run rampant in what should be a nice tax and regulated arrangement.
No, I think you've got it. That's the bottom line here is if cannabis was taxed and regulated, then we would have some leverage for testing the product, to have some basic safety guidelines for the manufacturer of the product. I mean, when's the last time you ever heard someone dying from bathtub gin or bad moonshine?
And in fact, when we look back at the pre-alcohol prohibition times, these weren't a big issue. My grandmother would tell me stories about this popskull, you know, gin that came out right from the still that would give you a headache so bad, you know, you could hardly recover. And it was, again, because of impurities and a rapid move to try to produce things too quickly in order to make a quick profit. And again, it's so much different in the, in the medical cannabis culture, for example, where people take a lot of pride in an excellent product that provides genuine relief of specific symptoms. And if we could have that kind of opportunity for brand loyalty and really, a genuine concern about quality, it would really improve things nationwide.
Now, on another subject here, this is something you and I had discussed briefly, but I don't know if we brought it up on the audio stash, had to do with some researchers here that were looking into marijuana addiction, the big term we're hearing lately, marijuana addiction, and how they thought they might treat these addicts with lithium. And I thought I ought to get your opinions on that idea.
It's funny because it just seems like when the cure is worse than the disease, so to speak, I'm stunned that people even thought this was a good idea initially, but these were some researchers in Australia who essentially thought that maybe a rather high dose, 500 milligrams of lithium twice a day, could help people get through cannabis withdrawal. Well, anybody who's bipolar, I don't want to insult or hurt in any way. It can be a very debilitating problem. There are these periods of mania where you're highly irritable or energetic or enthusiastic or incapable of sleep, and then these absolutely debilitating, depressing moments that are long in duration and filled with sleep and concern and sorrow. And lithium genuinely can take the extremes out of those moods so that you're maybe cycling much more like the average person. Lithium, however, can be toxic at certain doses and has to be monitored very carefully, and it has some negative side effects that are nothing to play with, including weight gain, dry mouth, an inability to ejaculate for men, and sort of a blunted range of emotion, which can be troublesome when folks who don't have bipolar disorder take it. As we've talked about time and again, marijuana withdrawal, if it exists at all, is a mild decrease in hunger, a slight irritability, and a craving for pot. I mean, what a surprise. This is the horrid withdrawal we're talking about. And the notion that we'd go on a drug that has markedly worse side effects in order to get over what is essentially equivalent to, say, the withdrawal we get from caffeine is just nuts to me. And so I'd really like to see work like this take a back seat. And instead, let's talk about behavioral ways to handle decreasing cannabis use so that withdrawal is minimal, and instead focusing on problems rather than use. This idea that, oh, everybody needs to quit cold turkey and turn it over to their higher power or something immediately may not be the most adaptive approach to decreasing cannabis problems. Often cannabis problems are more about negative consequences from using in inappropriate environments or from using more than you planned on it or something like that. I know it's going to get me nailed to the cross on the cover of People magazine, but in fact, a lot of these people later in life learn to use less often in smaller quantities rather than quit cold turkey and still seem to avoid negative consequences. So I think that's the way this kind of work ought to go.
Well, on the bright side, if someone had a problem with marijuana addiction and then treated it with lithium and suffered all the side effects from lithium, they could use medical marijuana to treat those side effects.
And I'm sure they'd be happy to.
Get ourselves a never-ending cycle there. You know, when I first read that story about giving lithium to treat pot addicts, I was thinking, doesn't every pot addict have a copy of the lithium CD in their collection already? I mean, Nirvana's pretty popular with the marijuana crowd. Oh, boy. Well, we'll keep on top of all of these crazy reefer madness allegations and the latest studies every Wednesday with Dr. Earlywine here on The Stash. And Dr. Earlywine, happy 420 weekend to you.
Oh, and a happy 420 to you, Russ.
And we'll talk to you again next weekend. Thanks for joining us. It's tough talking to kids about marijuana, especially if you might be a parent who dabbled a time or two in your youth. So to help you out, get your copy of Dr. Mitch Earlywine's latest book, A Parent's Guide to Marijuana. Dr. Earlywine is an associate professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany and an expert on the studies concerning marijuana, its effect on health and society, and the methodology behind the statistics. He is a frequent guest here on our daily audio stash. Dr. Earlywine lays it all out without the propaganda and scare tactics that parents know won't work with teenagers. He presents a rational understanding of cannabis, what it is and what it isn't, and why kids shouldn't be using marijuana. You can order today through Amazon.com or check our links at our blog, stash.normal.org. Here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash, we work hard to change our nation's marijuana laws through education and discussion. But we also take the time to relax and unwind with an eclectic mix of pod-safe music from many independent artists. We look for music that speaks to the growing truth about cannabis, or music that speaks to broader themes of freedom, liberty, social justice, equality, and protest. To find out more about the artists and download the music you hear on this podcast, just log on to stash.normal.org. And if you'd like to get your music heard by the online cannabis community, just send us an email at stash@normal.org. Hooray, we made it past tax day. Here's a little celebration ditty for getting through our yearly ordeal. Khmer Kid brings us his infectious groove hit, Smoke Weed. The Kid is an Asian rapper from Los Angeles, and his song will stick in your brain and have you grooving all day. This marijuana anthem is Khmer Kid's best-known tune, but he is currently working on some new material and has a new video out on the web. You can check out the video at aznraps.com or search for it on YouTube. Right to the point, Smoke Weed is the perfect advice to celebrate tax day behind us and 420 before us. Khmer Kid has a MySpace page. You can get the link at our blog at stash.normal.org, as well as the MP3 download for this song. It's Khmer Kid and Smoke Weed.
Craziest pipe ride up inside. watch me. My rhyme about my life on this MIC tonight. Ripping through the show, you know, till all of your speakers blow. Bees picking up so high like weed, we need not to smoke the seed. Beezing up on the window for my weed one and my two rides. Spit my rhyme about my life on this MIC tonight. Ripping through the show, you know, till all of your speakers blow.
Here from peopleradio.com, and you're listening to Normal, the podcast for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Oh, I didn't know they needed reforming. It's illegal, you say? I'll be right back. Sorry, I had to flush my goldfish down the toilet. What was this about marijuana? Oh, well, now on with the show.
We're joined by the executive director of California Normal, Dale Geringer, who's on the phone with us from California. Thanks for joining us, Dale.
Good morning.
Hey, we've got some good news we want to pass along to all the folks that are following medical marijuana, Prop 215, and especially all the people that have to work for a living out there. Tell everyone about the assembly bill that just passed committee.
We have a bill, AB 2279, by Mark Leno to protect workers' rights if they're medical marijuana patients so that they cannot be fired for positive drug tests or for simply being medical marijuana patients. It's to reverse a recent Supreme Court decision here we had, which said that Proposition 215 medical marijuana law didn't protect workers, and so a company was allowed to fire somebody for simply being a medical marijuana patient based on the fact that he didn't pass a pre-employment drug test. We were really gratified by the positive reception we got in the first Assembly Committee, Judiciary, the other day, and we're hopeful that we're going to be able to get this passed through the Assembly. People, I think, really do understand that medical marijuana users should be protected like other drug users are, legal drug users, when it comes to taking marijuana to improve their workplace productivity, presumably.
Now, this, you mentioned the case. That was the Ross versus Raging Wire case.
Ross versus Raging Wire was the decision. And this is a bill to undo that.
Now, this you had mentioned specifically pre-employment drug testing. Does this also count for on-the-job random testing?
Except for safety-sensitive jobs or law enforcement jobs, actually, which
okay.
are exemptions to the bill and are also covered by federal law.
Yeah, I was wondering about that federal state conflict.
But for other employment situations.
Okay, so if a California company, I know a lot of these companies will fight back against medical marijuana, saying, "Well, we have contracts with the federal government that say we have to have a drug-free workplace."
Well, that'll be a valid excuse, no doubt.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's good to know. We want to make sure we're clear on all of this. So it just passed it passed the committee on a 6-3 vote, 6 Democrats in favor, 3 opposed.
Yeah, party line vote as usual.
Yeah. So what are its chances then once it hits the Assembly and the Senate in California?
Well, that's a good question. It's going to be close. Any limitation on employers' rights is always a tough thing. And the Chamber of Commerce and numerous other business groups are against this bill, as is law enforcement. But we have labor on our side. The SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, is strongly supportive of workers' rights with regard to drug testing. So we have a fairly pro-labor assembly and Senate, and we're hoping that will make the difference for us.
Has there been any word from the governor's office on their opinion on the bill?
Well, I have to say that the governor's office does not have such a pro labor record the legislature does.
Well, we can always hope for the best, and every incremental step we make forward on this is a good thing. So,
well, it would be a major accomplishment to get this passed by the legislature to finally, it would be one, show some dissatisfaction with this whole urine testing regime, which is really, wrongly gotten the reputation for somehow being necessary to ensure workplace safety without really any evidence that it does that.
Yeah, that's certainly true. As we look at this effect from the Ross versus Raging Wire decision, do you guys at California Normal have any sort of estimate as to how many medical marijuana patients are in the workplace at this point?
No.
A percentage or?
No.
Oh, okay. But there's certainly a large portion of the medical marijuana patients in California that must be, in the workplace.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you're probably talking about tens of thousands, I'm sure.
Yeah, and any sort of institutionalized discrimination against people for using medicine is to be rejected anyway. Doesn't matter how many people are affected.
Yes, well, we'll see how this goes.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you, Dale, for giving us the update
on
the AB 2279. Thank you.
Mark Leno, and people should contact their assembly people now in California.
Do you guys have some action alerts up on the California Normal?
Yeah, there is an action alert at the California Normal website, canormal.org, canorml.org.
All right, that's all the info we need. Well, thank you, Dale, for joining us here on the Stash today. That's Dale Gehringer, the Executive Director of California Normal. Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.norml.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. We leave you today with our cannabis quote from Judge Robert Sweet, a U.S. District Judge in New York. Quote, "Finally, the fundamental flaw, which will ultimately destroy this prohibition as it did the last one, is that criminal sanctions cannot and should not attempt to prohibit personal conduct which does no harm to others." End quote. Absolutely right. Prohibition is bound to fail. You cannot legislate morality. I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us here at the Audio Stash. We'll be back tomorrow with more news and interviews for the cannabis community. Until that time, Take care of each other, tokers.